dissolving monstrosities into chance alignment of unconnected branches. Within minutes I could see the trail. I started to run. For all that time walking the path, I had wanted to break and run, but that way lies madness. You don't run from terror, not if you ever want to stop again. Now, though, with the red light shafting down all around me to dapple the ground in bright patches, I ran. Soon the focus reached its height, boiling through the clouds. The leaves began to steam, the icy rain, now a warm fog. I ran, and I ran, and I ran, and I saw him. Amando! Just a darker blur in the fog, but I cried out and raced towards him. The man who turned and caught my arm was taller than Amando, tall as any man in the village, all hard muscle, dirt, and the stink of old sweat, a beard tangled to the base of his neck. "Take her!" He passed me to another behind him and drew his sword. Even in the fog, the focus moon found dull glints among the iron plates on his leather shirt. "How many more of you?" he asked. There were four or five of the men. They all had the same iron-plated leathers, the same dark and heavy capes, red under the grime, rich cloth, the colours of some army, perhaps. Some had helms, the guards around their eyes lending a strange owlish cast to their faces. Strong hands seized me, hard and pinching. "Amando," she said. The tall man turned slowly in the steam and mist, sword before him. "I told you that weasel would be around here somewhere." He made something thin and high-pitched of his voice. "Amando! Amando! Help me, Amando!" One of the men holding me chuckled into his hand. "Make her sing," the tall man hissed. "That'll bring him if he's close." One of them twisted my arm behind me. I ground my teeth together and grunted. He tugged it harder and the pain lanced through me. It's easy enough to make a body hurt past the point of any resolve. Within a few more seconds I was screaming, and screaming was all I knew about. I don't know how long it took. It seemed like half a lifetime. It stopped, suddenly. The man doing the twisting let go and sat down, clutching his neck. The focus had nearly passed. The mists glowed crimson with the last of the light.
"What are you playing at?"
the man holding my other arm. Blood, dark as wine, leaked between the fingers his friend had clasped around his throat.
"He's here."
My captor drew his sword, still holding me.
"He's..."
The handle of a knife appeared under his chin, blade hidden in his neck.
"Get among the trees!"
The tall man barked the order and followed it in the same moment. The man holding me released my arm and wrenched the knife from his neck as if that might save him. He stood for three or four heartbeats, blood spraying from the wound, warm, the salt of it on my lips, then sank to his knees using his sword as support. He didn't look angry or scared, just disbelieving, eyes staring into the mist.
"Run, Nona!"
Amando shout. I saw a dark shape moving among the trees, cries, curses, the light dying moment by moment. A scream, a wet thunk, low branches snapping. My legs wouldn't take me anywhere. I'd nowhere to go. Darkness. No noise but the creak and moan of the realm once more, as if it had just bitten its tongue, waiting for the light to move on. I held my breath, and somewhere in the distance, just audible above the night sounds, the broken stumble of someone limping away or dragging themselves through the undergrowth. I stayed there, small and silent in the restless dark, waiting for the ghosts of the dead to leave their flesh and find me like they did in all the stories. But in the end the dawn made its way among the trees, and with it James Baker and Willem Streams. They weren't searching for me. They were thinking to catch up with Amando. Baker's hoard of coin went missing the day the juggler left. They were lucky only to find me, all bloody and surrounded by corpses. Nona drew a deep breath and looked up. "The rest is as I told you before. They called me a witch and a thief and gave me to the child taker." "Only your mother wasn't dead," said Clara, almost a whisper. No.
She let them do it, said Ruli, without surprise, as if perhaps her mother had done the same, albeit wrapped in different circumstances.
She said I'd helped Amando steal from the bakers. Nona bowed her head.
And that's why the judge came, Clara said. Because of the dead men and the missing money. Were they soldiers or some local lord's men?
I don't know. Nona got off the bed and went to her own, weighed down with memories and the lies she had told.
How did Amando throw his daggers?
Dula still in the other bed, frowning.
You said the mist was...
I'm going to sleep now.
Nona fell headlong onto her bed, and lay silent and unmoving until the lanterns were extinguished and the sounds of sleeping rose around her. Chapter 11. The focus woke Nona. Every crack in the shutters wrote itself red upon the dormitory walls, snaking over the novices in their beds, describing each in as few lines as Abbas Glass had used to capture Nona's face. She watched the lines move with the moon's passage, flowing over the sleeping forms about her. The building creaked and groaned as the heat penetrated. Somewhere far away, the great walls that stepped up to the white would be weeping, shedding rotten ice, losing the slow gains they had made during the day. That battle ebbed and flowed, of course. For a century, the Grey and all its towns and villages had been swallowed by an advance before the focus finally wore the ice back. Even now the topsoil lay thin, poor stuff that only the desperate would farm and the wild hunt upon. The glaciers had pushed the good black earth of millennia 30 miles into the corridor and made the Hernon territories the garden lands of empire. Nona lay back and thought of her village, the people scraping their living from the shallow ground. Even after just a few months, it was hard to imagine it, hard to imagine that their world rolled on without her.
Nona.
Nona sat up, looked around.
Nona.
Nothing. Nobody.
Nona.
For a moment the moon's light, caught in bright lines upon the floor, seemed to align into a single thread leading from the room. Nona slipped from her bed, barefoot on the cold stone. She wrapped a blanket around herself and followed, with the hall whispering all about her and her sisters sleeping.
You came!
Hessa sat on the steps of the scriptorium across the square from the dormitory block, wrapped like Nona in a thin convent blanket. The heat from the focus moon made the puddle steam and set Nona sweating beneath her cover. Nona looked up. The line she had been following was gone. She wasn't sure now that there had ever been one.
Why are you up?
I don't sleep well.
Hessa patted her bad leg.
Not since the cage.
She frowned.
Not since ever.
Nona sat beside her on the steps.
It's a strange place, this convent.
Yes.
I don't trust them.
Hessa shrugged.
I like most of the nuns.
I don't trust the ancestor either, Nona said. But I'm not running away. Not yet, anyhow.
The faith is one thing. The church and its people are another.
Hessa shifted her leg and leaned back to bathe in the moonlight.
You can believe in the ancestor or not, but the church is just people, some good, some bad.
They sat in silence for a long minute, then another, the focus reaching its peak and starting to slide.
I had a bad dream,
Hessa said. Nona looked around at her.
About Marcus.
Marcus?
Nona hadn't thought of the boy since she cut down Raymel Taxis.
Where did Giljan sell him? Did he have to throw 4 foot into the bargain?
She smiled, remembering Marcus's bond with the child taker's mule.
I had a bad dream,
Hessa repeated herself, staring over the rooftops, a tremble in her voice.
But the real thing was worse.
She turned to Nona.
I can show you. I think. Sister Pan said I had a gift for stories, for the path they take, and memory is its own story with its own path. Show me.
Hessa reached out her hand, cupped and ready, her eyes on Nona's, and Nona, having nothing else to give, placed her own there. Hessa turned Nona's hand, palm up.
I've only tried this with Sister Pan. You might get a sort of fuzzy idea or nothing. Nothing is probably better.
She set her index finger so that the edge of her nail bit against the base of Nona's palm.
I might have to do this several times.
She started to trace a line across Nona's palm, scoring hard enough to make her want to fold her hand up.
What?
Hessa's story swallowed Nona's voice first, then took the rest of her. The Academy purchased Willem and Chara. Like the Kaltus, it kept a reserve of young potential. But while Partness Reeve stored his children among the sacks and boxes in his attic, the Academy had a school for the purpose, a sprawling range of buildings that looked to Hessa more like a fairy castle than a place to teach ragged peasants plucked from Giljon's cage. Forefoot's hooves clattered on the cobbles as he brought them in under a great sandstone arch, every inch of it carved with sigils, some that seemed to fold the world around them, and others that made her smile, laughter bubbling up from places Hessa had forgotten even before the journey. A strange energy suffused the air, tingling on Hessa's skin, pricking along her cheeks, singing in the marrow of her bones.
"'You're as close now to the Emperor's palace as you're ever likely to get.'
Giljon seemed nervous. Worry looked as out of place on him as kindness or sentimentality might.
"'Closer than most ever get. The Academy Hall lies behind this school, and it practically backs against the Ark.'
He brought Forefoot to a halt before a complex of buildings, under the watchful eyes of stewards in spotless black uniforms.
"'Get out!'
Giljon ushered them from the cage.
"'Quick about it!'
He aimed a half-hearted swipe at Marcus.
"'And try to look valuable, damn you!'
They had been examined, all four of them. Marcus and Hessa, too, in a hall as grand as any church. Each of them, in turn, inspected across the width of a polished ebony table. Hessa sat in the uncomfortable chair that Giljon had carried her to, on a cloth that the academic's assistant had laid atop smooth wood. The assistant had wrinkled his nose as he retreated. In this place Hessa supposed even Giljon looked like a beggar. He stood ill at ease among the gleaming marble columns, watching as Marcus took his turn at the table. The academic sat in a high-backed chair, itself a work of turned pillars and ornate turrets. Her fingers steepled before her, thin arms emerging from sleeves of lustrous purple fabric, embroidered with the same sigil repeated time and again. Her neck seemed too long and thin to support her head, and all across one side of it a stain spread, a dull scarlet thickening of skin, like a hand reaching up to choke her. She spoke to each of them at length, looking down from her elevation with coldly curious eyes. Hessa came away confused and drained, as if each answer had taken something from her. When it came to the sale, Giljon had none of the banter that he had shared with Partness. Rather, he spoke more like a stallkeep at a peasant market, faced with some high lady wandering through for a moment's diversion. He stated his price, and the academic either paid or inquired after the next child. For Chara and Willem, she handed over 12 crowns apiece, more for each of them than Partness had given for all 8 that he took. The dark boy. He's likely to show some Margil blood, but his aura is too wild for academy work. He'll end up a hedge mage or turn native. If that happens, better he end up with a forestling than take to the tunnels, mark me. The academic turned away down the long gallery of pillars, and Giljon pushed her purchases after her, his hands to their shoulders.
And the girl?
Nothing. Perhaps she sees the path. Perhaps someone taught her what to say so that she might get fed. Take her to the sisters. Or Caiaphas, if he'll see you. Or one of the rogues. I don't really care. The path is not academy business.
After the academy, Giljon drove his cart along the smaller streets, muttering to himself. The tenements had a sour smell, and tall chimneys behind the houses pumped out a dark, almost green smoke that even the wind didn't seem to want.
"Damned if I'm taking you to the witch girl!"
Giljon raised his voice without warning, turning in his seat.
"I don't like the way she looks at me. Besides, it's a steep hall to the convent, and the mule ain't up to it."
Hessa shrank back into the far corner of the cage, raising her hands. Witch, mage, academic. It made no difference to her. They all sounded terrifying.
"I'll take the boy to the church first. The priest knows his business. Not a judge of that one."
Giljon shook the reins, and Forefoot picked up the pace. The sky lay sullen overhead, the air heavy with the kind of heat that makes a body sweat. They passed through the dour streets of the east side, and came by rising and tree-lined avenues to a more opulent quarter where, over a sea of tiled roofs, the spires of some great cathedral challenged the sky. Hessa felt as uncomfortable passing by the good folk of Verity as she had beneath the academic scrutiny.
"They don't look like they're real people,"
Marcus whispered beside her. Hessa nodded. All of them, whether old or young, whatever their shade or blood, seemed a different breed. Glowingly clean, full-fleshed, their clothes both strange and costly. Hessa had seen the major of Morltown once, back in the grey, as he passed by on his horse. Here even he would look shabby, his colours dull. Giljon drew up beneath a large tree and jumped out into the road.
"Covering you up, stay hid."
He pulled out the hides he hung when the rains came and pushed them through the bars. Hessa and Marcus hunched down beneath them. They rattled along in stifling darkness for a while, with only the change from cobbles to paved road and back again to mark their passage.
"I didn't like that woman," Marcus said.
"The academic? She was strange."
"My great-nan was a hedge witch. She said that the Margils who work with the land don't twist like the rest. That's why they hate us."
"Twist?"
Hessa lifted the edge of the hide for enough light to see Marcus's face.
"Twist!"
He put a hand to his neck where the woman had borne a livid mark.
"The Margil tribe learned the deeper secrets of their world, tasted its blood, knew it down to the bedrock and beyond. They let them work it with their minds, draw on its strength, understand its beasts and draw its fire. But this isn't that world, it belongs to someone else. You take too much here and Abath takes back. This place still belongs to the missing."
Giljon drew up again.
"Wait here."
An age later, or perhaps a couple of minutes, Giljon returned and drove the cart around a corner into some echoing space. He halted and pulled the hides clear, leaving Hessa blind in the daylight. First, she saw that they were in a high-walled garden on the gravel between house and grounds. Next, that the house was as grand as any she had yet seen. The windows beneath huge sandstone lintels boasting sheets of glass bigger than her head, held within a criss-crossing of wooden frames.
"Priest'll be out in a minute,"
Giljon said.
"Show him what he's looking for, boy. He's not a man you want to disappoint."
Hessa shuffled along to sit on the tailgate, while Marcus clambered out and went to stand beside Giljon, up by Forefoot. The garden walls seemed to hold back what little wind the day had to offer, the air hanging close and wet around them.
"He's a priest?"
Marcus asked.
"Of the ancestor, so mind your heathen mouth."
"I'm not a heathen."
The main door to the house opened, a tall and exquisitely dressed man stepping through. He took in the cart and three travellers with a disapproving eye, as if mere proximity might sully the dark blue of his velvets. A moment later the priest walked out, a broad-chested guardsman behind him. Hessa stared, lips parted. The servant had been more richly dressed than anyone she had ever seen, but the priest wore a robe of dark material that seemed to glisten even as it ate the light, so thick and so folded that stretched out it might cover the cage that for months had been her home. Gold chains gleamed on both his wrists. An amethyst the size of a hen's egg hung from the rope of woven gold about his neck, and in his right hand he held a sickwood staff, the end stamped with the alpha and omega of the ancestor, each letter inlaid in silver.
Giljon, I hope your arrival was unremarked. What do you have for me?
The priest spoke with casual authority, making no effort to hide his distaste.
The boy, your worship, Margil Trueblood, thought of you straight away. He's the sort you sent to that monastery on the coast. More than attaching him, make a finer mystic brother this one would.
On the road, Giljon had ruled them with an iron hand and dealt with the farmers of the Grey as if he were a lord dispensing favours. But here, with the stone house rising before him and formal gardens to his back, he seemed a peasant himself, servile and ill at ease.
I've had 7 boys off you, Giljon. Abbot Tay reports that only 2 showed any touch of Margil, and one of those was half wild.
He descended the steps, staring at Marcus.
The wild ones have to be broken early if they're to be kept. Break them properly and their minds can be retrained to more useful ends. But it's a lot of effort.
Strong signs with this one, your worship, strong signs. Half-blood at the least. Clever, too. Could take to sigil work double quick.
Giljon nodded. The priest, though short beside his guard and Giljon, loomed over Marcus. He looked an old man, his hair grey, face craggy, but his eyes were sharp, slicing across Hesse, discarding her. His arm, when he reached for the boy, was snake-fast.
Sigil worker?
His hand fastened about Marcus's wrist.
A wild boy.
A sharp jerk brought Marcus staggering forward with a cry. Fast as the priest was, Forefoot moved faster, leaning in to bite the fingers clutching Marcus's wrist. The priest released him with an oath, and Forefoot set to braying loud enough to bring maids to the upper windows to stare. Giljon, all apologies, stepped in to check the hand the priest held cradle to his mouth, but the guardsman sent him reeling back with a straight arm to the chest.
"Never seen that mule bite anyone before, your worship. Ancestors' truth."
Giljon looped an arm about Marcus's neck and pulled him back behind him.
"It's the Margil in the boy, like you said, your worship. Wild. But empathy can work on people, too, if it's trained right. That kind of influence can be gold in your pocket."
"It's empathy, you idiot. Not empathy."
The priest lowered his hands, one clutching the other, red-fingered. He had blood on his mouth, too, and an ugly look beneath it.
"And there are 100 touched whispering to beasts for each prime that can turn a man's mind, and 10 primes for each full blood that can own it. But I will take the boy. And the mule."
"Ah, well, the lad's 20 crowns, your worship, like a son to me he is, but Forefoot, he's not for sale. Been with the old fella 12 years now."
"You'll take 10 for the boy, and a crown for the mule. You'll get a young one for pennies at the Brown Fair. My gardener and his son will help you push your cart there."
The guardsman stepped in close behind the priest's shoulder. Giljon swallowed, still holding Marcus behind his back.
10? 10 I can take from a man of the cloth, a sign of my devotion to the ancestor. But Forefoot..."
"You'll sell me that mule, Giljon, or you'll never sell anything in this city again. A word in Captain Hurston's ear, and the guard won't even let you pass the city gates. So, enough with this foolishness. A crown for a vicious mule that's a season from being rendered for glue and hound meat."
The priest waved to his servant.
"Pay the man."
"Don't do it!"
Marcus broke free of Giljon and ran to Forefoot, taking the mule's head over his shoulder.
"He wants to hurt him!"
The adults paid no attention. The servant produced a worn leather pouch from within his velvets and brought forth the first crown to count into Giljon's palm. The child-taker held out his hand reluctantly, face twitching with warring emotions.
"Don't!"
Marcus shouted, eyes wild.
"It was my fault, not Forefoot's!"
The servant laid the crown on Giljon's creased and dirty palm, a silver coin, polished with use, traces of tarnish in the grooves picking out the Emperor's features. He counted out the rest, each clinking against the next. At 10, Giljon closed his hand.
"See, Forefoot is family."
"The animal bit me."
The priest held his hand up, sticky trickles of blood reaching down as far as his wrist. "Accept your coin, child-taker. Or are you so wealthy that you'll sacrifice your livelihood over an elderly mule?" The servant pushed the last coin into Giljon's half-open hand. The rain that had threatened for so long began to fall.
"Tie the beast up, over there. Use a heavy rope."
The priest gestured to the pillars holding the roof above his rear door. Giljon took Forefoot's halter in his hand, ignoring Marcus's cries.
"Sorry, lad," he muttered as he took the mule.
Forefoot let himself be led, but whinnied his distress, rolling a dark liquid eye at Hessa. She clutched herself tight, not wanting to see but unable to look away. Giljon left Forefoot tied to the nearest pillar, with the thick tow rope used to get the cart, and sometimes other travellers, out of deep mud. He returned to the cart, looking a poorer man despite the additional silver in his pocket. The gardener and his boy came to roll the cart back out through the gates, but the priest didn't seem inclined to wait.
"You know, Giljon, how to break someone?" "Of course you do. The Skithroll had you a while, did they not?"
Giljon said nothing, just bent his back to the task of pushing. But before his shoulder set against the cart's edge, his hand reached up to touch the empty socket of his left eye. The rain thrummed down around them, dripping from Hesse's nose, running down the bars of the cage.
"You break a man or a boy most easily by breaking something that they love. Better still, if it loves them too."
The priest's voice didn't turn them, but the crack of wood against flesh and the startled bray did. He had his staff raised again as Hesse looked around, both hands at the end swinging it over his shoulder.
"No!"
Marcus darted forward, but the guardsman caught him by an arm. The priest swung again, with all his strength, bringing his staff down across Forefoot's back. The mule, already straining, threw himself against the rope, braying his surprise and pain. The priest struck again, and again, and Forefoot strained against the rope, eyes wild and staring. Marcus was screaming, struggling to be free, but over the cracks of each blow and Forefoot's loud distress, Hessa couldn't understand the words.
"You don't!"
Giljon stood and raised his voice and his hand before letting both fall. Rainwater trickled from the socket of his eye in place of the tears that should have been there.
"You don't! Pullin's all he knows. He thinks you want—"
Giljon shook his head, lowering his face to hide his emotion.
"Stop him,"
Hessa begged. But Giljon, the thick-set gardener, and his lean son all looked away, each of them broken in some manner that Hessa, even with her useless leg, was not. The staff made its own rain of blows, thick and heavy, the tempo regular, not frenzied. The priest, breathing hard, marked each blow with a word.
"You bit me, you filthy animal!"
Forefoot, the fur across his back and sides dark with blood, threw his weight against the rope, anchored to the immovable pillar, not braying now, but heaving desperate breaths through a muzzle thick with crimson-specked foam. Giljon and the gardener pushed the cart. The boy unbarred the gates, all of them needing to be away from there. Hessa, in the cage and paralyzed with grief, found she couldn't draw breath, couldn't move. Her chest hurt, her face contorted into a grimace so fierce it hurt. The priest's cruelty had reached inside and twisted something vital, drawn it to a breaking point, reducing her to snot and tears. Through half-blind eyes she watched Forefoot strain, hard enough to burst his heart, uncomprehending beneath the blows, knowing only what his simple life had taught him, to pull. With his own animal cry, Marcus got his teeth into the guardsman's knuckle. Rain-soaked, he was hard to hold on to. He twisted free while the man whipped his hand away, cursing. Marcus ran, not for the priest, but for Forefoot, throwing his arms about the mule's neck, pressing his face to an ear. The priest's next blow hit Marcus's hip, not with the same fury as those for Forefoot, but loud and hard and agonizing. Even so, Marcus hung in place. Hesse didn't see it. She didn't hear it. It registered on none of her senses. But inside, in the core of her, she knew the moment that Marcus found the edge of his power. Whether it was a word whispered into Forfoot's ear, or something that bled between them from hand to hide, Hesse couldn't tell. What she saw was Forfoot raise his head, unflinching, as the next swing of the staff cracked more ribs. The mule snorted, the kind of snort he would give for a fresh meadow of long grass or a delicious bank of kelimbine, and pulled again. The pillar shifted. The thick mass of stone, 15 feet high and wider than a man, jolted forward. Amid the spilling rain, terracotta tiles came flowing from the roof above, a waterfall in red. The priest went down beneath them. A heartbeat later, the rope snapped, and Forfoot collapsed gently, his legs folding beneath him. Marcus followed him down. The mule took one more shuddering breath and died. The scene narrowed, narrowed again. The priest's gates closed behind the cart.
No! No!
Hesse shouted, but the hands kept hold as she struggled.
No!
She opened her eyes. Hesse was leaning over her, the moonlight bright behind her.
Hesse!
And Nona knew herself again.
I thought I was you.
She reached up, and they held each other as they had back in Giljon's cage, weeping together as if tears might somehow wash away the pain. Chapter 12.
Tell us, then.
Clara put down her fork and stared pointedly at Jula.
What?
Jula crammed in another mouthful of bread.
Woff. You know, Ruli said. Her story.
Clara tilted her head ever so slightly towards the far end of the red table. The four of them were huddled at one end. Arabella held court at the other, her group the larger.
Ara says. Ara? Who's Ara?
Clara's face hardened.
Arabella, Jula replied. Everybody calls her Ara. You know that.
Her friends do.
Jula shrugged.
She's okay. It's not her fault she was born so rich. Anyway, do you want to hear her story or don't you?
Clara tapped at her plate.
Go on.
Well, Jula looked around, savouring the attention.
Well, the priests have been going on about the Argatha for years, right? But over the last few months they've really been building up excitement, sending assessors out to the provinces, even to the wild towns along the border.
Argatha?
Nona hunched in, waiting to be told how stupid she was.
It's an old prophecy, Ruli said quickly. A holy witch called Sister Argatha made it, back when the first emperor took the Ark from the Sumerians. It says that the Ark will open when the four tribes demand it with one voice.
Couldn't you just get a Geraint, a Hunska, a Margil and a Quantel to do it?
Asked Nona.
Right, that's what I said, Jula nodded. But they tried that ages ago and it didn't work. So ever since then the priests have been saying one voice means one person exhibiting all the bloods.
Everyone knows it's just theatre to take people's minds off the war that's coming, Clara said.
Every time there's a crisis and the Emperor wants to shut up dissent, all of a sudden there's a big hue and cry over searching for the Chosen One. That's what my father says.
She trailed off, staring at the table.
So the Abbess thinks Arabella's going to show up as both the Mage Blood?
Nona asked.
Pan seems pretty sure she's Quantel, and more than a touch, Jula said. A touch doesn't count. You could have a touch of all four and nobody would get excited. Sister Kettle's a Hunska Prime with a touch of Margil,
and nobody's calling her the Argatha's chosen one.
She is? Nona asked.
How do you know?
Kettle can shadow weave. It's the easiest Marjal trick, and even touchers can do it near the ship heart.
Does the Abbess think Arabella will show up Geraint, too?
Nona frowned.
Arabella was far from the tallest in the class.
Unless she's six and nobody told me, then she's not Geraint.
She's close on 11, Jula said. But sometimes Geraint doesn't show till you're grown, and you just don't stop growing. Anyway,
she pushed her hands together as if trying to steer the conversation back on track.
Anyway, Ara's family saw how quick she was, and because she didn't look Hanska, that got them worried. So her father took her to the academy.
Stupid thing to do, said Clara. Once the academy knows, everybody knows. Too many fingers in that pie.
Your father say that too?
Ketty slid her chair noisily over to join them, wiping her mouth. Clara turned on her, eyes fierce, and Ketty raised her hands.
My father collects taxes. He says if the Emperor wasn't standing behind him, he'd be called a thief every day.
Anyway, Jula raised her voice, then lowered it, glancing down the table at Arabella's group, deep in their own conversation. Only Hessa and Genna sat alone in the middle of the table now, opposite each other, focused on their plates.
The Emperor called her whole family to court, so Malcolm Jotsis, Arabella's uncle, who's head of the family, gathers everyone at his estate out in Lido, and then leads them all to the palace. But on the way, they're intercepted by Shazal's house troops. Like 100 of them. All the way from the Skithrol border. And this was just days after the testing at the academy.
What did they do? Ruli asked.
Nothing, Ketty said, earning a scowl from Jula as she stole the story. Because the Jotsis had already sent Ara on in secret with 4 trusted men to meet with the Abbess so she could join the convent.
Which, said Jula, pushing both hands back across her bristly scalp, puts her out of the Emperor's control, and even his sisters aren't mad enough to try to steal a novice. And however much High Priest Jacob is pressed, he can hardly give her up what with all the noise the priesthood have been making about the Argatha.
Exactly. Clara stood up, brushing crumbs from her habit. None of them really expected to find a candidate, so they didn't have a plan for what to do if one turned up.
Academia that morning saw Clara and Nona first through the door. Sister Rule waited behind her desk, massive even when seated, her headdress bulging as much as her habit, as if it too had a lot to confine. The Abbess's cat, Malkin, lay on the desk in an arthritic coil.
"Good morning, Mistress Academia," they both chorused, taking seats at the front of the class.
Sister Rule watched them with dark eyes and said nothing. Behind them, other novices began to file in. Nona's gaze was drawn again to the globe on the mistress's table. Abbath wrapped in ice with its thread-thin girdle of green. Nona had always considered the corridor to be vast, endless, really. It was hard to imagine how much space there had been before the ice advanced.
Why?
So many questions twisted half-formed across her tongue that Nona didn't know what she would say before the words came.
Why isn't the moon round, too?
Sister Rule's voice overrode the smirks from behind her.
That, Nona, is an excellent question. Though you should say, why is the moon not also a sphere?
Sphere? Nona rolled the word in her mouth.
Why do you think the moon should be a sphere? Sister Rule asked.
Well, Nona didn't really know, it just seemed right.
Well, the world is, and in the sky Baden is round sometimes, and a crescent other times, if you really squint at it. And at the Hope Church they say that Baden is a whole world like ours, not a star like the Hope, and that Baden isn't coming to save us like the Hope is, because Baden is ice and more ice and lock to our sun just like we are.
Nona took a breath.
So I just thought that everything really really big seems to be round. She looked up at Sister Rule, who it had to be said was really big and was not spherical, beginning to head that way. Sister Rule only had to reach for her yardstick to silence the titters.
You know that with the blessing of the ancestor, our forebears put the moon in the sky in the distant long ago, Nona?
Nona nodded. She wasn't wholly ignorant, though she didn't know the name for the shape of the moon. Sister Rule reached into her drawer and picked out something. She raised her hand and held it towards the class.
The moon?
A silver circle square in her palm. She turned it sideways, and Nona saw with surprise that it was a dish, paper thin.
Watch!
Sister Rule held the moon, behind Abatha's globe, positioning it where the morning sun slanted down from the windows, filling it full of light. She tapped the globe, and Nona saw a bright red spot, moving as Sister Rule moved her hand and the moon held in it.
All the light it gathers is thrown down onto this one spot, the focus. Put your hand there, child.
Nona stood and did as she was told.
It's warm. Hot.
And that's how the moon keeps the corridor open. The sunlight from a large area focused by a vast mirror into a small area. There's no reason for it to be circular.
Sister Rule put the mirror away.
We stand between two huge walls of ice, Nona, and the winter has been coming for 50,000 years.
She held her hands as if they were the two walls and pressed them together with disturbing finality.
Today, though, we're talking about rocks.
The girls groaned at that and got out their slates. Nona did her best to pay attention, but rocks proved less interesting than they sounded, and they hadn't sounded that interesting to begin with. Time and again she found herself thinking of the moon that some distant ancestor of hers had set to hang above the world, and about how one thin and breakable mirror seemed to be all that stood between everyone she might ever know and the ice advancing from north and south. After lunch, Clara led Nona to the novices' cloisters, flipping her penny as she went.
"Why are you always playing with that?"
Nona asked. It seemed that Clara, who thought herself poor, now her family's fortune lay ruined, considered the penny a trivial sum, no more than a toy. But Nona had seen a child purchased from her parents for a single penny, and to see one tossed about so lightly always gave her a sense of disquiet.
"My father gave it to me. Told me to learn how to turn one into many."
Clara shrugged.
"The corridor is divided into 100 lands, maybe 1,000. But you know what doesn't care about those borders, or who rules there? 2 things.
She counted them off on her fingers.
The corridor wind and money. Traders move through it like blood in a body. No queen or emperor is stupid enough to try to stop them. That's why the rich spice their food with black salt from the mines in Cremont. Nobody from Cremont has ever set foot in the empire. But the money flows and the trade flows."
Clara picked her penny up and caught it.
"Money is at the centre of everything we do. It has the loudest voice."
She sounded as though she were quoting her father.
"But you're training to be a nun. Nuns don't have money."
Nona wasn't even sure if Clara was allowed to own the penny. She certainly kept it hidden in classes.
"When I'm trained, I'll leave."
She put the coin into a pocket.
"The kind of education we get here is highly sought after."
But Nona was going to ask who paid her confirmation fee. It must be a hefty sum to pay for board and keep along with an education that gave such valuable qualifications. But she bit down on the question, not wanting to find it pointing back at her. Instead, she nodded.
"I'm going to do the same thing."
She thought of the priest who took Marcus and beat Forefoot to death.
"I don't want to be a nun."
The novices' cloisters proved to be a galleried walkway around the internal courtyard of the building that served both as laundry and repair for nuns and novices alike. 50 or so novices of all ages either walked slow circuits, chatting as they went, or sat on the long stone benches looking out through the arches onto the gravelled yard at the middle. At the middle of the yard, a single huge tree, the centre oak, spread its branches.
though quite what anchored it to the rock, Nona couldn't guess. "The nuns' cloisters are much grander," Clara said. "The sisters come out in the dead of night and lie in the center waiting for the focus."
"No, they don't," Nona said.
"Naked." Clara nodded her head.
"Clara!"
Ruli made a face. "Well, they didn't do it when I was sleeping in the cells," Nona said.
"You were sleeping,"
Clara said. Nona tried to imagine Sister Wheel, Sister Rule, and the matronly Sister Sand moonbathing. "I think you're the one who's dreaming, Clara."
"We've got Shade next,"
Jula came to join them, squeezing between Nona and Ruli.
"Have you told her yet?"
"Told who what?" Clara fell silent as Arabella walked past with several girls in tow. She always seemed to be laughing. Nona didn't think she would be laughing if she had had to leave the luxury of life in a noble family for the convent, and had assassins trying to kill her.
"About the poisoner,"
Jula said as soon as Arabella had passed. Clara rolled her eyes.
"I hope nobody tells Arabella."
Jula turned towards Nona, face earnest.
"Mistress Shade always poisons new girls."
"What?"
"Tries to," Clara said, as if it were nothing. "Well, I haven't seen her fail yet."
Jula pressed her lips into a thin line, remembering.
"She got you, Clara, and me, and Ruli."
"I was sick for days," Ruli mind throwing up. "I played up in Blade just to get my head shaved so I wouldn't get vomit in my hair."
"So don't eat anything she gives you," said Jula.
"Or let her touch you," said Ruli.
"Best just let her do it. She'll get you anyway,"
Clara said.
"It will be fun to watch, at least."
"Clara, I meant funny to watch Arabella get done," Clara spoke across Jula's objection.
"That's terrible," Nona scowled.
"Doesn't the abbess know?"
"I think the abbess encourages her,"
Clara gave a crooked grin.
"If being poisoned is the worst thing that happens to you in Mistress Shade's class, then count yourself lucky. She's the meanest bit—"
"Clara!" Jula seemed to suffer coarse language as though the words were physical blows.
"Well, she is. Nobody gives punishments like her. It's her sharp tongue that's the worst, though. Never answer her back, Nona. She can take you apart with a sentence."
Bray sounded sonorous and lingering across the cloisters.
"Time to go."
Clara got to her feet in a hurry. She had never looked properly worried about being late before.
"You could have warned me earlier,"
Nona grabbed her shawl.
"About the poisoning."
Clara shrugged.
"There's nothing you can do about it. Besides, it's not something anyone wants to talk about over lunch."
They joined the elbowing crowd struggling to leave through the main arch.
"She poisoned the soup for Grey class once. Got all of them, just because none of them passed an exam."
They got to Shade breathless. The lessons were held in the natural caves that riddled the thickness of the plateau. Mistress Academia had been explaining something about their formation in the previous class. Rainwater dissolving paths through the rock, if Nona remembered right. It didn't sound right.
"We're not last," Clara slapped Nona's arm. "You never want to be last to this class."
They came up short at the steps down into the caves, a narrow flight sealed with an iron gate just a few yards in. The steps lay behind Hart Hall, and were so close to the plateau's edge that Nona wondered if the caves might not reach the cliffs and open out like hungry mouths. A tall, slender novice with dead-white skin and dark hair stood at the top step, marking off the girls' names on a slate as they arrived. She glanced Nona's way with blue eyes of an unnatural and alarming shade.
"That's Benta," Clara whispered. "From Holy Class. She's the poisoner's assistant in the laboratories. Don't mess with her."
A minute later, Benta looked up from her slate and took a hefty iron key from a pocket inside her habit.
"All here, then. Novice Hessa, good to see you've graced us with your presence this time. Novice Jula, you appear to have had a close shave since our last lesson."
"She tries to be snarky like the poisoner," Clara whispered. "She can't really do it."
Novice Clara, get your tongue out of that new girl's ear, and pay attention to the steps.
Benta clipped Clara around the head as they passed her. The steps led steeply down, the limestone in places oozing and thick with slime. In some spots, Nona thought that Benta, bringing up the rear, would have to duck in order to avoid scraping her head. Within a few steps, a faint stink began to wrap them. The stink of lye, sour wine, and other components Nona couldn't name. She wrinkled her nose as the smell grew stronger. The daylight followed them further than Nona had imagined, and just as it grew so dim that she started to have difficulty seeing the steps, another source of illumination took over. The new light turned out to be a fat candle positioned in a niche at a bend in the descent. Its light carried them down to a section of hand-hewn tunnel with a wooden door to one side, before which the girls started to queue. Benta came down, snuffing the candle, then squeezing past the line to push into the room beyond. The girls followed her. This chamber was also hand-hewn, though perhaps from a smaller natural cave, as some areas on the soot-stained ceiling looked irregular and didn't show any pick marks. Light entered by several horizontal shafts in the far wall, each 5 or 6 foot long and showing patches of sky. Nona guessed they must open onto the cliffs. 3 long tables ran the length of the room with benches to either side, and all manner of jars, pots, glass bottles, and sealed gourds arranged along the middle of each. At the far end, a nun stood with her back to the door, writing on a chalkboard. The novices seated themselves at the tables without the usual fuss of who sat by who. The woman at the board was neither tall nor short, shapely certainly, but Nona couldn't guess at her age other than to say, not old. Benta closed the door, and Mistress Shade, the poisoner, turned around with a warm smile for the class.
"Ah, Nona dear, do come up here. And you, Arabella. I always like to take a good look at the new girls."
Nona blinked and stood.
The poisoner had had a pretty good look at her already in the bathhouse.
"Yes, Sister Apple," she said.
They came to stand before Sister Apple, Nona shooting a sideways glance at the Jotsis girl, apparently serene despite just 2 nights ago sinking a knife into the spot where Nona had been sleeping. The idea that Arabella could hide her murderous instinct so deep that not a trace showed on the surface unnerved Nona more than the act itself. She knew her own emotions were written across her face the moment she felt them, possibly even before.
"I do believe you're less skinny already, Nona. Another year of convent meals and we might have a decent amount of meat on those bones. And Arabella Jotsis, a pleasure to have you join us. What is it like to be a part of prophecy?"
Sister Apple raised her hand as Arabella opened her mouth.
"Best not to answer that one, dear."
She took an embossed tin, enameled in black and white from her habit, and opened it with a squeeze that sent the lid springing back. Inside were 12 translucent yellow balls, each no larger than a thumbnail.
"A sweetmeat to welcome you to Shade Class. We're going to have such a good time."
She smiled that same slow and easy smile she first greeted Nona with on the way to the convent.
"I've stuffed myself."
Nona held her stomach. She had, in fact, stuffed herself as she did at every meal, but the sweetmeats did look enticing, glowing like the stained glass in Path Tower.
"A pity."
Sister Apple turned to Arabella and held the box out.
"Thank you."
Arabella reached out and took one daintily between thumb and forefinger. Nona noticed that both digits had a waxy sheen to them.
"I'll save it for after class."
Sister Apple closed the box and tucked it away.
"To your seats then, girls. We've a lot to learn today."
Nona followed Arabella back to the nearest of the 3 long tables. The older girl returned to her place first, wincing as she sat, then shifting position with a frown. Nona found her place and lowered herself towards the bench before pausing, held by a sudden suspicion with her backside just 1 inch or 2 from the polished wood. She shifted and turned, narrowing her eyes as she made a quick study of the area beneath her. Something glinted. A short pin held upright on a tiny dark base. She flicked it to the floor and sat. Benta must have placed the thing while Nona was up at the front of the class.
Well done, Nona!
Sister Apple clapped her hands.
Arabella, less well done.
Nona looked at Arabella. The girl's face had a peculiarly stiff look to it, just her furious eyes and twitching grimace to indicate she wasn't simply concentrating on Mistress Shade's words. She jerked her body minutely to the left, but seemed incapable of more movement.
You passed the test, Nona,
Sister Apple smiled.
I won't try to trick you again.
She turned back to the chalkboard, where she tapped her chalk against a leaf shape, then underlined the word beside it.
Today, we will be learning how to brew catweed to potency, a close cousin to Segrin root from which I made the tincture that was on the pin trap Nona so cleverly avoided, and Arabella did not. Commonly, we call the tincture lock-up. The first... A tap-tap-tap on the door turned Sister Apple back towards the class. Come?
Sister Kettle poked her head into the classroom, a mischievous grin on her face.
I've just come from the scriptorium to give Nona her writing supplies.
She pushed fully through the half-open door, a dark slate in one hand and chalk sticks in the other.
For our lessons together.
Go on, then, Sister Apple smiled tolerantly and waved Sister Kettle in. The younger nun, Nona thought Kettle must be 20-something to Apple's 30, tiptoed over in exaggerated fashion and placed the slate and chalks before Nona on the table. She removed a folded wiping cloth from her habit and set that down between them before mouthing sorry at Mistress Shade and tiptoeing out, waving to the novices from the doorway once out of sight from the board.
As I was saying, Sister Apple rapped the board, catweed.
Nona looked down at her new possessions, her only possessions other than the quill, scroll, and ink the abbess gave her, and a briefly owned knife. She picked the slate up, marvelling at its even corners and uniform thickness. The Biggs in Nana Even's seven-day class sat with rough pieces of slate they had dug themselves from Ebsen's hole. While Sister Apple continued to describe the locations in which catweed might be found, Nona set the slate back down before her, finding it slightly sticky. Her fingertips held a brownish stain where she had touched it, and had a faint smell of rot.
Catweed in its natural state can be eaten without adverse effects, Sister Apple continued. Though you would be advised against consuming it in quantity, that would lead to stomach cramps and numbness in the extremities. Besides, it has a sour and unpleasant taste.
Sister Apple continued to expound upon the merits of catweed for several minutes, before pausing to look at Nona.
And how are you feeling, novice?
Nona licked her lips. Her mouth felt strangely dry and cottony.
You lied.
She discovered herself weak in every limb. An attempt to rise merely made her slump over the table.
It was entirely evident that I was trying to poison you, Nona dear. You don't think that someone who would poison you might also stoop to not telling the truth on all occasions? Liar.
No part of Nona's body would obey her. Where Arabella had gone rigid, Nona had turned limp. But neither of them had command of their muscles. Sister Apple crossed the room to stand beside Nona, setting a hand to her shoulder.
Do you know what the most insidious poison is, Nona?
Sister Apple pursed her lips.
That means worst.
The table filled most of Nona's vision now, as her head met it. She could see Sister Apple from hips to ribcage, Arabella's arm, Clara behind them both.
Catweed got your tongue?
Sister Apple retrieved the slate with a cloth-wrapped hand. Trust, Nona. Trust is the most insidious of poisons. Trust sidesteps all of your precautions. Behind the nun, Clara rolled her eyes.
So give your trust sparingly, or better still, not at all. And, novice Clara, you will be grinding stink corns in the fume cavern for an hour after the lesson finishes.
Chapter 13 Shade class passed slowly, But with little else to pay attention to, Nona learned a lot about the properties and preparations.